serious crises before, from Indochina and Taiwan to Hungary and Suez, as well as Little Rock. But the Sputnik crisis was different from these, for it struck at a fundamental claim of his administration, that it was possible to wage the Cold War in a patient, disciplined, and fiscally sensible manner. Sputnik opened the door to sharp criticism. Had America been sleeping while the Soviets stole a march in the missile race? Had the warrior statesmen failed to keep the nation prepared? Eisenhower's answers to these pointed questions would define the rest of his presidency. 3. That Sputnik became a major and enduring political crisis for Eisenhower had everything to do with Lyndon Johnson. On November 25, 1957, the same day that Eisenhower suffered his stroke, Johnson began his promised congressional hearings into the alleged failings of the U.S. missile program. Johnson had emerged in 1957 as Eisenhower's chief political antagonist, gutting his civil rights bill and controlling the Senate and the Washington press corps with enormous skill. With the president incapacitated, the energetic and forceful Texan sought to take center stage. Sputnik offered him an opportunity to keep his name in the headlines by leading a well-publicized investigation into the American failure to beat the Soviets into space. From late November through early January, his preparedness subcommittee of the Senate Armed Services Committee called in hundreds of scientists, military leaders, and government officials to explain why America had fallen behind and what must be done to catch up to the USSR. Although Johnson theatrically stressed his desire to keep politics out of the hearings and promised not to wander up any blind alleys of partisanship, his committee brought out into the open a number of critical facts that made Ike look bad and lent support to the perennial theme of a dangerously disengaged chief executive. The subcommittee's first witness was Edward Teller, the controversial Hungarian-born scientist who designed the hydrogen bomb. Teller had been a leading critic of J. Robert Oppenheimer and was loathed by many in the intellectual and scientific world. But he spoke his mind, as Johnson expected, and delivered a stern rebuke to the idea, recently mooted by Eisenhower, that Sputnik posed no military threat. "It has great military significance," Teller countered, "because it showed how advanced the Soviets were in rocket propulsion, guidance systems, and fuel technology." The matter was simple. If the Soviets controlled space, they could control the Earth. In a spellbinding 2-hour performance to a packed hearing room, Teller detailed the many ways that Soviet science had left the Americans behind and profoundly vulnerable. Others concurred. Vannevar Bush, the leading science and engineering administrator during the Second World War and now at MIT, stressed the huge advances the Soviets had made. "We have been complacent and we have been smug," he sternly insisted. "The persistence of inter-service rivalry slowed advances," he said, "and the nation had paid insufficient attention to scientific education. All this had to change if the United States was to survive." General James Doolittle, who had helped reorganize the CIA in 1954, suggested the Defense Department be overhauled to strengthen the Secretary of Defense and impose order on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. "We must develop a sense of urgency," he demanded. Lieutenant General James Gavin, Army Deputy Chief of Staff for Research and Development, insisted the Soviets were ahead of the United States in almost every area of weapons and technology. And Wernher von Braun, the man who directed the Nazi V-2 program and who had been designing missiles for the Army since the end of the war, gave shocking testimony about the bureaucratic tangles and lack of steady funding that had slowed missile research. Von Braun said the Army could have launched a satellite in 1956, but the Pentagon halted his efforts. And so the hearings went, painting the picture of a defense establishment that was badly organized, led by a weak Secretary of Defense, slowed by endless committees, tangled in red tape, underfunded, and beset by inter-service rivalry. Worse was yet to come. For the most significant and damaging testimony given to Johnson's committee came from a leading member of the administration, none other than Alan Dulles. On November 26, the second day of the hearings, the CIA chief, accompanied by Herbert Scoville, the assistant director for scientific research, gave the committee a top-secret briefing about Soviet military and technological capabilities. Dulles informed the senators that since the Sputnik launch, his agency's analysts had grown increasingly worried about the pace of Soviet missile production. There did indeed seem to be a missile gap opening up between the two superpowers, and the danger was growing. Many historians have claimed that Eisenhower never worried much about the alleged missile gap because he had available to him the top-secret photographs taken by the U-2 spy plane that showed a tiny and unimpressive Soviet missile program. This oft-repeated assertion is misleading. In fact, the 13 U-2 flights the CIA conducted over the USSR between June and October 1957 provided no comfort at all. These overflights reaped a bonanza of information, capturing pictures of the Soviet missile testing facilities at Kapustin Yar, near Astrakhan, as well as the nuclear weapons research at Semipalatinsk in northeast Kazakhstan. The flights also discovered an intercontinental ballistic missile site at Turatam in southern Kazakhstan, from which Sputnik would soon be launched. The U-2 photographs taken in the month before Sputnik revealed a large and growing Soviet nuclear weapons and missile testing program. Exactly how far the Soviet Union's new rockets could travel, how many it planned to build, how accurate they were, all that remained unknown. But the liftoff of the R-7 rocket on October 4th with the Sputnik satellite on board confirmed Americans' worst fears. The Soviets clearly did have an ICBM and were trying to build more. The U-2 flights provided priceless information, yet because of the extreme risk of the illegal overflights, Ike believed the shootdown of a U-2 might well trigger a war. He did not persevere with them. From mid-October 1957 until December 1959, a period of more than 2 years, he approved only 2 flights into Soviet airspace. The U-2 was all but grounded. Instead of illegal overflights, CIA analysts had to rely on a second means to observe Soviet rocketry. In early 1955, the United States had deployed a sophisticated radar system in eastern Turkey to monitor tests of Soviet missiles. This testing data, far from reassuring the Americans, showed the astonishing frequency of Soviet missile tests, nearly 300 between 1953 and 1957. And the approximate range and altitude of the missiles the Soviets were developing. Although most of the missiles they tested were shorter intermediate range, it was clear they were trying to achieve long-range ICBM capability. CIA analysts combined the radar data, the U-2 photographs, and their analysis of the rocket that carried Sputnik into orbit and concluded that they had underestimated Soviet missile capabilities. This explains why, when Alan Dulles went before the Preparedness Subcommittee on November 26th, he presented such an arresting account of Soviet missile progress, even more dire than the report he had given to the NSC just a few weeks earlier. The USSR, the CIA now claimed, would have an operational ICBM big enough to carry a one-ton nuclear warhead some 5,000 miles as early as 1958. A year sooner than predicted by the Gaither report. The present trends continued. It could have 100 ICBMs by the middle of 1959 and 500 by the middle of 1960. This information, though classified, was a bombshell. Putting all his authority and credibility on the line, Dulles told a handful of senators that the Soviets were about to take a dangerous lead in the missile race. Dulles wrote these alarming new figures into a revised intelligence estimate on Soviet missile capabilities given to the NSC on December 17, 1957, labeled SNIE 11-10-57. This document asserted that the Soviet ICBM program had an extremely high priority and was even running on a crash basis. In the midst of the Sputnik crisis and the Johnson hearings, these initial predictions of an imminent wave of new Soviet ICBMs directly contradicted Eisenhower's public reassurances. Dulles knew exactly what he was doing. A dire report about a Soviet lead in the missile race would prompt congressional outcry and lead to increased dollars for the CIA's espionage capabilities. Dulles therefore gave Johnson and his fellow committee member, Stuart Symington, a magnificent opportunity to use the still raw intelligence the CIA had gathered to damage the Eisenhower administration. By the end of the hearings, a bleak picture had emerged. The scientists, the military experts, the engineers, and especially the top intelligence analysts now asserted that America faced mortal danger, and that if the nation did not respond immediately, the Soviet Union would turn its mastery of science into domination of the world. 4. Were things that bad? Was America truly vulnerable? Ike did not think so, and his confidence derived less from his limited knowledge of the Soviet missile program than from his detailed knowledge of the vast American one. Contrary to the claims of his critics, Eisenhower had been pushing hard to prod the Defense Department to develop a new arsenal of nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them. Although he had done a poor job of informing the public and shaping the narrative, by the end of 1958, the United States stood on the threshold of a dramatic breakthrough in the missile and space race. After World War II, America's missile program evolved slowly, taking a back seat to the development of the Strategic Air Command's fleet of long-range bombers, which remained the chief delivery system of America's nuclear deterrent. Still, missile research quietly went ahead, leavened by the knowledge and experience of German scientists like Wernher von Braun, whose V-2 rocket served as a prototype for the U.S. Army's first ballistic missile, the Redstone. By September 1956, von Braun's team had developed a rocket called Jupiter C, an intermediate-range missile that had the potential, its designers believed, to place a satellite in orbit. But they did not get the chance to prove their claim before the USSR put Sputnik into space. The reason for this missed opportunity was simple. Eisenhower had decided in 1955 to make the construction of an intercontinental ballistic missile the overriding priority of the U.S. missile program. He sidetracked satellite research into Project Vanguard, a second-tier program run by the Navy. This decision followed the recommendation of the February 1955 Killian Panel, which declared long-range rockets vital to sustain the effectiveness of American deterrence. In late July 1955, Eisenhower received a briefing by Air Force missile engineers, who insisted that the rapidly shrinking size and weight of thermonuclear weapons, combined with increasingly powerful rockets, had brought the United States and the Soviet Union to the edge of a new era of missile technology, in which the great powers could strike devastating and unstoppable blows at one another. After a summer of debate, the National Security Council determined that beating the Soviets to the ICBM was a matter of great urgency, and that building the long-range missile was a program of the highest priority above all others. Under direct presidential pressure, missile research made rapid progress. The Department of Defense gave the Air Force the green light to build two ICBM systems, the Atlas and the Titan. Once operational, each of these behemoths would be able to carry warheads with the explosive power of 1.4 megatons and 4 megatons, respectively, over a distance of 5,500 miles. By comparison, all the bombs used in World War II amounted to approximately 3 megatons. A single one of these missiles could obliterate a large city in a flash. The Air Force planned to have the Atlas missiles operational by 1959 and the Titans by 1960. ICBMs alone were insufficient, however. The Pentagon also wanted intermediate-range ballistic missiles, IRBMs, designed for deployment in Europe as a counterweight to Soviet pressure on America's NATO allies. At the end of 1955, the Defense Department had added an IRBM program to its high-priority list and divided up the spoils across the services. The Air Force got funds to proceed with a land-based IRBM called Thor. The Army would move ahead with Jupiter, and the Navy would develop a sea-based IRBM called Polaris for use on ships and submarines. Despite the obvious risks of overlapping efforts and inter-service rivalries, Eisenhower was determined to press ahead with all of these rocket designs. To his advisors, he said, he was absolutely determined not to tolerate any fooling with this thing. We had simply got to achieve such missiles as promptly as possible, if only because of the enormous psychological and political significance of ballistic missiles. Not since the Manhattan Project of World War II had the United States invested such effort in the production of a weapons system, and the cost was enormous. Spending on the IRBM and ICBM programs together jumped from $161 million in 1955 to $515 million in 1956 and $1.3 billion in 1957. These rockets, built in conjunction with private industry, created an immense web of military procurement. For the Atlas rocket, the Convair Corporation of San Diego built the frame. General Electric built the guidance systems, the Rocketdyne Division of North American Aviation built the engines, and Burroughs Corporation of St. Louis built its computers. The Glenn L. Martin Company built the Titan missile using guidance systems provided by Bell Telephone, engines built by Aerojet, and computers built by Remington Rand. In all, the Atlas, Titan, and Thor projects involved 18 principal contractors, 200 subcontractors, and 200,000 parts suppliers. The major contractors alone employed some 70,000 people. The missile race funneled the dramatic expansion of the military-industrial complex. Despite the enormous complexity of these missiles and the engineering challenges they presented, American scientists made rapid progress. In September 1956, von Braun's Redstone missile, Jupiter C, fired a test rocket a distance of 3,355 miles. In 1957, the Thor missile went through 8 flight tests, and by October 1957 had proven it could fly on target over 2,000 miles. In June, the Air Force started tests of the Atlas ICBM in a rush to make it operational. Meanwhile, the Army developed various short-range nuclear-tipped missiles with enduring folksy names such as Corporal, Little John, Honest John, and Davy Crockett. And the Navy pushed ahead with innovative plans for Polaris, a solid-fuel missile, actually built by Lockheed, that promised greater stability on ocean-going vessels than the liquid-fueled IRBMs. The Polaris program started development in late 1956. Less than 4 years later, on July 20, 1960, the submarine USS George Washington launched a Polaris missile while submerged, a breakthrough of enormous strategic significance. Plenty of missteps dogged the missile program. On December 6, 1957, America's first attempt to launch a satellite ended in disaster. At Cape Canaveral, in front of a crowd of media and onlookers, a Vanguard rocket shuddered, rose 2 feet in the air, then exploded in a fireball. The failure dealt a stunning new blow to American prestige, the Los Angeles Times concluded. Lyndon Johnson called it one of the best publicized and most humiliating failures in our history. Wags renamed Vanguard Sputternik. The engineers learned from their mistakes, as scientists do. On December 17th, the Air Force launched the first fully successful test flight of an American ICBM, the Atlas. Just when Sputnik triggered an avalanche of criticism, Defense Secretary Neil McElroy, who had replaced Charles Wilson in the fall, told Eisenhower that December 1957 had been the most active and successful month to date in the ballistic missile flight test program. Within 2 years, by the end of 1959, squadrons of Atlas missiles, each 100 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb, stood as silent sentinels across the American landscape, ready for liftoff. The still more powerful Titan missile would be available for use by 1960, and a second-generation solid-fuel missile called Minuteman was being rushed into production. Missile bases sprang up in North and South Dakota, Montana, Nebraska, Wyoming, Colorado, Kansas, California, Texas, eventually 19 states in all. Meanwhile, the construction of the signature long-range bombers of the Cold War, the B-47 and B-52, proceeded at breakneck speed. Hundreds of these monstrous aircraft were kept in the sky 24 hours a day, armed with nuclear weapons and ready to fly to Moscow on the president's order. Eisenhower pushed forward this huge expansion of the U.S. nuclear deterrent because he had come to accept a basic paradox of the Cold War, that the only way to avoid using weapons of mass destruction was to build more of them. He did not do this only as a result of the Sputnik crisis. These projects had been in the works for years. By the time Sputnik had made its first trip around the Earth in October 1957, the United States was well on its way to building the strategic triad, a three-pronged deterrent of bombers and land-based and submarine-based ballistic missiles that defined America's nuclear arsenal for the entire Cold War. The accusation of complacency or smugness thrown at Eisenhower bore no relation to the facts. The nation stood on the threshold of breakthroughs in every conceivable kind of strategic weapon and rocket technology. Perhaps the Americans were slightly behind the Soviets in missile research. Perhaps not. As of late 1957, nobody knew for certain. But Eisenhower did know this. In the race to build the next generation of nuclear weapons, the United States planned to win. 5. Eisenhower's response to the Sputnik crisis encompassed more than missile construction. In fact, he moved decisively on three fronts, diplomatic, institutional, and political, to take control of the problem. In mid-December 1957, he took a much-publicized trip to meet with the heads of state of the NATO countries. It was only 3 weeks since his stroke, but he knew the world needed to see a vigorous president in command. And he himself viewed the trip as a personal test. He feared that he might end up like Woodrow Wilson, whose severe stroke in late 1919 had left him incapacitated and irrelevant. "I was going to make sure it would not happen in my case," he later wrote. Eisenhower arrived in Paris on a cold gray day, but found the Parisians in a warm and welcoming mood. His route from the airport was lined with cheering onlookers who seemed to have forgotten the bitter dispute over Suez just a year earlier. Ike and John Foster Dulles, still recovering from his recent surgery, brought with them what they considered an enormously valuable gift. The United States proposed to construct in Europe a stockpile of atomic weapons, held in joint custody between the Americans and Europeans, and the United States would agree to transfer some of its new Thor and Jupiter IRBMs to Europe. These weapons would show America's determination to defend its allies from Soviet nuclear blackmail. The countries hosting such missiles would share with NATO's supreme commander, always an American, any decision about their use. Sending IRBMs to Europe seemed a sensible way to balance the Soviet lead in the missile race. While explaining to the press his enthusiasm for nuclear proliferation, Dulles asked why the Soviets should be allowed to threaten Europe with nuclear weapons, while the Europeans could defend themselves only with weapons from the pre-atomic age. The more nukes on the doorstep of the USSR, the better, as far as Dulles was concerned. In addition to offering nuclear missiles to European allies, Eisenhower beefed up defense spending. Over the New Year holiday, he closeted himself with his advisors at Gettysburg and hammered out the details of the 1959 budget proposal to Congress. He decided to ask Congress for immediate passage of a supplemental spending package of $1.3 billion to accelerate missile production and improve early warning radar systems. He also asked for a $40 billion defense budget, about $1.5 billion larger than the previous year. Overall, his budget request was $74 billion, a substantial increase from the previous year, and the largest peacetime budget in U.S. history to that time. After years of fighting the upward trend of government spending, Ike admitted the need to plow more money into defense. Congress wanted more than spending, though. They clamored for leadership. Given Eisenhower's recent stroke, congressional critics worried about his capacity to lead. The president himself, after 5 years of apparent immunity to attack, is now on the hot seat, one Washington Post writer claimed. In the words of the politically sacrilegious, his halo has slipped. The Democratic Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn, opined that Ike had not shown enough urgency. He needed to respond to a nation that had been disturbed and humiliated by Sputnik. "We are in a struggle for survival," he insisted. Eisenhower knew what the critics were saying, and he planned to answer them in his State of the Union address, scheduled for January 9, 1958. Commentators believed the speech would be one of the most important of his career. Just after noon on the big day, Ike and Mamie left the White House in a huge Chrysler Imperial, itself a tribute to the rocket age, with its enormous tail fins, rocket-like fenders over each headlight, and tail lights formed to look like aircraft gun sights. They drove down Independence Avenue to the south entrance of the Capitol. Mamie, in a natty gray wool suit, mink stole, and blue pillbox hat, proceeded into the executive gallery of the House chamber, receiving a thunderous ovation. Eisenhower waited in Speaker Rayburn's office until he was beckoned to the floor of the House. Doorkeeper William Fishbait Miller announced the arrival of the president, and the members erupted in hearty applause. During his relatively short speech, Eisenhower delivered what had been lacking so far since the October 4th Sputnik launch: a clear sense of direction for the country in the new missile age. He finally admitted that Americans had been spooked by Sputnik and demanded a response. He proposed a series of imperative actions to fix the problems that the Sputnik crisis had revealed. He wanted a reorganized Defense Department to halt the crippling inter-service rivalries that had slowed missile progress. He wanted an immediate infusion of cash to improve radar capability, bomber dispersal, missile production, nuclear submarines, and mobile conventional forces. He wanted to help America's allies by lowering barriers to trade and by sharing nuclear secrets so they could better defend themselves. And he wanted major federal investment in scientific education. Such actions would ensure that America's military and scientific power, already strong, would never lapse. Such a program would require sacrifice, a word he used throughout the speech. The people must know that to counter the Soviet Union's total Cold War against America, they would have to toil and strive with common purpose. "The world is waiting to see," he declared, "how wisely and decisively a free representative government will now act." The speech reflected Eisenhower's belief that while arms were certainly expensive and might have seemed wasteful, they provided the foundation for order in a disordered world. He asked Americans to accept the basic unpleasant fact about the Cold War: to deter war, America must prepare for it, and that meant investing in science, technology, and education, as well as arms manufacturing. For Eisenhower, the purpose of such a titanic effort was not war but peace, an armed and anxious peace, but peace nonetheless. Here lay the basic national security principles of the age of Eisenhower. Critics hailed the speech as a success. It was forceful and incisive in content, spirited and vigorous in delivery, wrote speechwriter Emmett Hughes. Sam Rayburn called it the strongest, I think, the president has delivered to the Congress. The Washington Post described it as among the best speeches of his presidency. "The president shows his stuff," was the Los Angeles Times headline. It also mattered that Ike looked so good. Arthur Kroc wrote in the New York Times that the speech swept away any lingering doubts about the president's physical vigor. This was no semi-invalid, but a man who seemed to be in excellent physical condition. The sense of relief as to his condition was tangible on the floor and in the galleries. Perhaps even greater relief flooded across the land on January 31, 1958, when at long last the United States successfully put its own satellite into orbit. Belying his breezy assertion that there was no satellite race, Eisenhower wanted an American craft in orbit immediately and pressed his scientists to get it done. He no doubt regretted his decision of 1955 to downgrade satellite research, but now he wanted results. When the Navy's Vanguard rocket blew up on the launch pad in mid-December, von Braun's Army team in Huntsville saw its chance. They adapted a Jupiter C rocket with an extra booster stage and strapped on a 30-pound pod of instruments that included a small radio transmitter. They called the satellite Explorer, and on the night of January 31st, they successfully shot it into space from Cape Canaveral. The president received word while at the Augusta Golf Club. "I sure feel a lot better now," he happily sighed on hearing the news. As he put it in his memoirs, a long and difficult period had ended. Americans cheered this welcome sign of a comeback in the space race. Officials in the nation's capital issued happy statements, and down in Huntsville, Alabama, where the Jupiter C was made, townsfolk rushed into the streets in celebration. One citizen carried a hastily daubed placard reading, "Move over, Sputnik! Space is ours." 6. As he plotted his post-Sputnik strategy, Eisenhower benefited from the guidance of James Killian and the President's Science Advisory Committee. The men who joined PSAC came from leading universities, and many had records of extensive wartime and public service. This group of technocrats offered Eisenhower well-informed judgments about science and technology that he could not find among the military, and they applied cutting-edge research to matters of national security. Killian saw PSAC as a voice of sense and moderation in the midst of the Sputnik panic. The scientists came to admire Eisenhower enormously. Killian described Eisenhower's deep interest and his extraordinary capacity to evoke the best from those around him. He was exceptionally responsive to innovative ideas. Eisenhower, in turn, felt deeply devoted to the men he called my scientists. He told Killian much later, "This bunch of scientists was one of the few groups that I encountered in Washington who seemed to be there to help the country and not help themselves." With PSAC, Eisenhower pressed on with a series of crucial administrative actions. On January 27th, he announced a major federal commitment to scientific education. The idea that American schools and universities had fallen behind the Soviets in the fields of engineering, math, and physics had been suggested to him by his science advisors in their first meeting after the Sputnik launch. Edward Land, the genius behind the U-2 plane, spoke to the president eloquently about the failures of American scientific education. The Soviets, he said, regard science both as an essential tool and as a way of life. They are teaching their young people to enjoy science. The president must inspire the country to embrace scientific inquiry rather than material pursuits. Eisenhower became a great enthusiast of science education, and in January 1958, he described an ambitious plan to overhaul science teaching, train a new generation of science teachers, provide scholarships and graduate fellowships for work in scientific fields, and promote the study of foreign languages. He wanted to make science a prominent part of American life. He saw his plan as an emergency program to enhance the nation's security. It was going to cost $1 billion over 4 years, a huge investment. Congress, under the glare of the Sputnik crisis, fell in line behind the proposal, and in September 1958, Eisenhower signed the National Defense Education Act, NDEA, into law. Eisenhower also embraced the idea that the country needed a federal agency to lead non-military research on space, and on April 2nd, he proposed the creation of the National Aeronautics and Space Agency, NASA. The idea grew in part from Eisenhower's conclusion that to leave space exploration in the hands of the military would stifle innovation and encourage more fighting among the services over money. Most of his scientific advisors agreed, urging him to commit resources to space exploration as a matter of human curiosity rather than warfare. And the best way to attract leading minds to work on space was to separate it from purely military projects. In remarkably rapid fashion, Congress passed legislation creating NASA, and Eisenhower signed the bill on July 29, 1958. Eager to suppress the persistent inter-service rivalry inside the defense establishment that had slowed missile development, Eisenhower, on April 3, submitted to Congress a plan to strengthen the powers of the Secretary of Defense over the individual military services. The plan would allow the Secretary to channel funds directly into key programs, a change from the usual practice in which each service went to Congress separately and sought money for itself. After a summer's worth of negotiations, Congress passed and Eisenhower signed the Defense Reorganization Act of 1958. It allowed greater concentration of authority in the hands of the Secretary over the individual service chiefs and also approved the creation of a new Director of Defense Research and Engineering, the Missile Czar, that Congress had called for. Defense Secretary McElroy gave the job to Herbert York, a nuclear physicist and Manhattan Project veteran who was running the Lawrence Livermore facility in California. These three major legislative moves, the NDEA, NASA, and Defense Reorganization Act, marked an extraordinary period of activity for the President and Congress, and they all responded directly to the challenge of Sputnik. Combined with his beefed-up defense budget, these actions revealed a shift away from the small government republicanism that Eisenhower cherished. The missile race, and for that matter the Cold War, required robust military-industrial-scientific collaboration on a nationwide scale, the sort of thing that only the federal government could direct. As the leading historian of the space age has said, Eisenhower had to discard the old verities about limited government, local initiative, balanced budgets, and individualism. The United States had to respond in kind to Soviet technocracy. Some of the actions Ike took were invisible to the public. On February 10, 1958, just 2 weeks after the successful launch of the Explorer satellite, James Killian and Edwin Land brought Eisenhower a proposal for yet another technological marvel. Ever since the U-2 aircraft had begun to fly missions over the Soviet Union in search of photographic intelligence, Eisenhower had been anxious to avoid violations of Soviet airspace. With the success of Explorer, Killian and Land now envisioned a replacement for the spy plane, a satellite that could take photographs and then jettison a recoverable capsule with the film inside. The satellite could be designed to emit no signals so that it would be completely covert, and either aircraft or naval vessels would recover the dropped film. Because of the scale and complexity of the satellite program, it would need the cooperation of the Air Force, the CIA, and a new office in the Defense Department created on February 7, 1958, called the Advanced Research Projects Agency. Eisenhower applauded the plan, but insisted on absolute secrecy. Only a handful of people should know about it, he ordered. In mid-April, Eisenhower orally approved what became known as the Corona Project, which planned to use Thor rockets to put camera-equipped satellites into orbit above the USSR, Eastern Europe, and China. It was a long, hard road to success. The first 12 Corona satellites malfunctioned. But on August 19, 1960, a Corona satellite that had passed over the communist bloc successfully dropped its payload of film to Earth by parachute, where a waiting Air Force C-119 snatched it out of the sky, using a long grappling hook extending from its fuselage. 6 days later, Alan Dulles and Eisenhower stared at photographs of the Soviet Union taken from space. This one satellite mission, said the secret CIA history of the program, yielded photo coverage of a greater area than the total produced by all of the U-2 missions over the Soviet Union. For the next decade, the United States used the top-secret Corona satellites to take detailed photographs of virtually every corner of the globe. By the summer of 1958, Eisenhower had established his post-Sputnik strategy for the space race. He accelerated the ongoing missile programs and channeled $4 billion more into the defense budget. He brought leading scientists into a close working partnership with the White House. He strengthened the powers of the Pentagon to control inter-service squabbling. He intensified work on a secret reconnaissance satellite, and he signed key pieces of legislation that reshaped the role of the federal government in space exploration and science education. In doing these things, he framed outer space as a new frontier of Cold War rivalry, requiring the United States to be strong and bold in space technology, in order to enhance the prestige of the United States among the peoples of the world. Above all, in these years, he set in motion a great national effort to construct and deploy a sophisticated missile capability with truly awesome destructive power, such that by 1961, the United States could wipe out most of the human beings in the Soviet Union in an instant. These patterns of action look clear to us now, but in the atmosphere of panic and accusation that Sputnik had triggered, Eisenhower's steady policy response to the Soviet missile challenge did not look so clear, and that left an opening for his critics to exploit. 7. On the morning of July 30, 1958, readers of the Washington Post might have choked on their breakfast cereal when they came to Joseph Alsop's column titled "The Gap." Alsop, one of the most well-connected journalists in the Capitol, claimed to have seen classified materials proving that up through 1963, the United States would be vulnerable to a massive Soviet missile attack. In the coming 5 years, he claimed, the American government will flaccidly permit the Kremlin to gain an almost unchallengeable superiority in nuclear striking power. The USSR was racing to put hundreds of ICBMs into action, Alsop asserted, while our missile programs are pitiable. According to Alsop, the Soviets would have 100 ICBMs ready in 1959 and should reach an output of 500 per year in 1960. They would have no less than 1,000 ICBMs in place against our 70 by the end of 1961, and as many as 2,000 ICBMs against our 130 by the end of 1963. How did Alsop know about the Soviet missile program? Very likely someone had leaked to him the contents of Alan Dulles' alarming December 1957 Special National Intelligence Report, SNIE 111057, though Alsop inflated even those dubious figures for maximum effect. 2 days later, Alsop threw another grenade in a column called Untruths on Defense, a piece bristling with outrage and high dudgeon. Alsop alleged that the Eisenhower administration is guilty of gross untruth concerning the national defense of the United States. The president had been consciously misleading the people about the state of the nation's defenses. Between 1960 and 1963, the Soviets could strike the United States at will using numerous rockets, the likes of which the United States did not possess. Massive orders for hardware must be placed immediately, he demanded. The last chance to save ourselves is slipping through our hands. Alsop kept up this barrage all week. On August 3rd, he declared that the Eisenhower administration deliberately sought to permit the Kremlin to gain an overwhelming nuclear striking power in the next 5 years. Once the Soviets achieved that superiority, Alsop warned, they would use it. Any man who is not intoxicated by official self-delusion must at least expect the Kremlin to threaten to strike the first blow. Alsop did not limit himself to attacking Ike's nuclear strategy. At the conclusion of this flurry of venomous columns in the first week of August, he went after the president himself. The leitmotif, Ike was washed up. Anyone whose private Eisenhower image is the vigorously striding, easily smiling, richly self-confident Eisenhower of the past is bound to be a little shocked by the Eisenhower of today. These columns marked the start of the 1960 presidential campaign and contained within them the chief lines of attack that John Kennedy would direct against the legacy of Ike. A failing and aging president had allowed America's enemies to prosper, and only youth, vigor, and boldness could save the country from a fatal slippage. Alsop's attacks had been previewed in the spring and summer when congressional critics, most notably Senators Symington and Johnson, had badgered the administration about its lackluster response to Sputnik. Symington, a presidential aspirant, lambasted Ike in a heated speech on the Senate floor in late May 1958, denouncing his ostrich-like state of complacency. In a familiar line of attack, he said, "Our government continues to place soft living and budgetary considerations ahead of national security." The Democrats kept up this drumbeat throughout the summer, as Johnson criticized Ike for spending too little on missiles. "The president lacks a feeling of grim urgency," Johnson insisted, and told Defense Secretary McElroy he was disappointed at the response to the Sputnik challenge. With powerful critics paving the way, the junior senator from Massachusetts, already considered a leading contender for the presidency, decided to join the battle. Armed with purloined data given to him by his admiring Georgetown neighbor, Joe Alsop, John F. Kennedy stood at his desk in the Senate on the evening of August 14, 1958, and delivered what was, up to that moment, the most important speech of his career. In a long and artfully crafted address, Kennedy attacked the Cold War doctrines of the Eisenhower administration. Not only had Eisenhower allowed a missile gap to open up, Kennedy asserted, he had also underfunded the conventional military arsenal of American power. The Soviets would now use nuclear blackmail to spread their influence, and America would be powerless to stop them. Their missile power will be the shield from behind which they will slowly but surely advance, through Sputnik diplomacy, limited brushfire wars, indirect non-overt aggression, intimidation and subversion, internal revolution, increased prestige or influence, and the vicious blackmail of our allies. The periphery of the free world will slowly be nibbled away. Eisenhower stood doubly accused. He had failed to build enough missiles, and he had cut conventional forces, thus hobbling America's response to the limited emergencies that burned across the developing world. Worse, his policy had been driven by a short-sighted emphasis on fiscal balance and tight budgets. The Eisenhower budget cutters had hollowed out America's military power, ceding to the Soviet Union the leadership in the Cold War. Kennedy looked to scripture for the right phrase to hang on the age of Eisenhower and found it. "The years the locusts have eaten," a tagline he would deploy again and again in the 1960 campaign. Alsop, who had urged Kennedy to make this speech, now went into print with unstinting praise for the young, hard-hitting senator. Kennedy's Senate address, gushed Alsop on August 18th, was one of the most remarkable speeches on American defense and national strategy that this country has heard since the end of the last war. Kennedy spoke candidly in the authentic voice of America. A star was born, and Alsop was not alone in noticing. James Reston, a wily observer of the political carnival in Washington, recognized that Kennedy's speech had vaulted him into the pole position for the Democratic nomination in 1960. "Senator Kennedy is on the make," Reston wrote. "He makes no pretense about it." The Democratic Party had found its candidate and a winning issue. Ike's insufficient zeal to confront the menace of Soviet power. Privately, Eisenhower fumed about Alsop's senseless diatribe. He viewed Alsop, a well-known bon vivant and irreverent gossip, as a man of low character, who brought disgrace on his newspaper. To old friend Bill Robinson, who used to be the publisher of the Herald Tribune, Ike seethed about Alsop's garbage. The FBI considered tapping his phone. In his public remarks to the press, however, Eisenhower simply dismissed the idea of a gap of any kind and insisted that American military capabilities are the most powerful they have ever been in our history. Eisenhower possessed more knowledge about the case than he let on. Although Ike had grounded U-2 flights over the USSR, his military and intelligence services carefully reviewed the radar data they possessed on Soviet tests of ICBMs and found, to their surprise, that such tests had not been frequent enough to indicate robust missile development. It was a puzzle. If the Soviets were building a fleet of hundreds of ICBMs, why had they tested so few of them? In fact, up to May 1958, the CIA could verify only 8 Soviet ICBM launches in total, including the Sputnik 3 satellite on May 15th. These rockets revealed Soviet technological advances, but were too few to indicate the existence of a major ICBM development program. Somewhat reluctantly, Allen Dulles had to report to the President and the NSC on August 27th that the intelligence services, while still certain of the Soviet desire for a large ICBM fleet, were pushing back by 6 months to the end of 1959 their prediction for an operational Soviet nuclear-tipped ICBM. In their new National Intelligence Estimate, SNIE 11558, they speculated that the USSR could have 100 of these by the end of 1960. It was still an alarming possibility, but not quite so alarming as the picture Dulles had painted for Congress in November 1957. This proved to be the first of many backward steps by the intelligence community. On October 9, 1958, Dulles initiated another review of the available radar data, still without any help from U-2 flights, and the lengthy report that emerged from an interagency review admitted, "We have no conclusive evidence that a Soviet ICBM production program of the type estimated in NIE 11558 is currently being accomplished." The report hastened to add that because of the restrictions on U-2 overflights, the available intelligence was incomplete, and so a final judgment remained elusive. But so far it was difficult to understand how the USSR could have a big missile program without conducting regular tests. By the start of November, the intelligence community again walked back by another 6 months their estimate of when the Soviet ICBM would be operational. Not until Eisenhower allowed U-2 overflight of the USSR in July 1959, and again in early 1960, did a clearer picture emerge. And it confirmed that the Soviet ICBM program had been significantly slowed down in favor of the production of intermediate-range missiles. But none of this could be communicated to the public for fear of revealing the top-secret overflights. The myth of the missile gap endured, kept alive by those who wanted an easy way to attack Eisenhower for his alleged complacency. 8. Ever since Sputnik went into orbit in October 1957, Eisenhower had endured insulting complaints about his flaccid leadership, to use Alsop's term. Quite possibly this context explains his uncharacteristic decision in mid-July 1958 to send a division of American soldiers to Lebanon to offer political and diplomatic protection to an ally, the Lebanese President Camille Chamoun. The origins of this decision lay in the ever-wider reach of Gamal Abdel Nasser in the Middle East. Since his triumph in 1956 over the Europeans, Nasser had meddled in the region, strengthening his ties to Syria and backing a coup in Iraq. Chamoun, a Maronite Christian in a multi-ethnic nation, feared that Nasser had his sights set on Lebanon as well. The link between Nasserism and communism lived mainly in the minds of American strategists. But even the chance of losing a pro-Western ally in the Middle East made Eisenhower and Foster Dulles deeply anxious. They viewed the Lebanon problem as a matter of prestige. If Lebanon were to collapse and be swept up in a Nasserite communist web of influence, Nasser's prestige would soar, America's would sag, and the Eisenhower doctrine would be seen as meaningless. "We must act or get out of the Middle East," Eisenhower told his advisors. Applying the logic of credibility and prestige, which his successors would do later in Vietnam, Ike saw Lebanon as another theater in which the United States was fighting the USSR. In a televised address to the nation, he invoked a doom-laden catalog of Cold War horrors, conjuring up the communist efforts to subvert Greece, Turkey, Czechoslovakia, China, Korea, and Indochina. Lebanon could be next, he warned. He sounded much like Anthony Eden on the eve of the Suez invasion, a fact Prime Minister Harold Macmillan gently pointed out. You're doing a Suez on me, he chuckled to Ike over the phone. On July 15th, 14,000 American soldiers, Army and Marines, splashed down on the beaches of Beirut in pleasant sunshine, where they were welcomed by sunbathing locals. The threat that these soldiers were supposed to guard against never materialized. No shots were fired or soldiers killed. Within 3 months, the troops were withdrawn. The Lebanon action, though, came at a cost. Eisenhower and Dulles forfeited whatever credit they had accumulated during the Suez Crisis and now appeared in Arab eyes to be acting like a colonial power. Instead of cultivating nationalist leaders in the region, they alienated them. Rather than enhance American prestige, the intervention gave the Russians the opportunity to denounce American imperialism. And it did little to bolster Ike's reputation at home. Most Americans seemed puzzled by the action and anxious lest the United States get caught in a briar patch. The headline in the Los Angeles Times caught the national sentiment. What are we doing anyway? If the Lebanon affair had something of the comic about it, the events in the Far East in the autumn of 1958 looked far more dangerous. What became the second Taiwan Straits crisis opened on August 23rd with a massive artillery barrage from communist Chinese batteries onto Quemoy, the small island held by Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists just a mile or so off the coast of mainland China, athwart the approaches to the city of Xiamen. Just why Mao chose this moment to restart the shelling of Quemoy remains a subject of dispute among historians. Most likely he had domestic political purposes in mind as he had just initiated the Great Leap Forward, a tumultuous period of collectivization and social upheaval. Generating an air of crisis through conflict with the Americans might help to inflame the people's revolutionary ardor. Mao also knew that U.S. prestige was at a low ebb in the non-Western world, due to its alleged failures to keep pace with the Soviets in the missile race, and because of its intervention in Lebanon. Whatever Mao's motives, this second artillery bombardment of Quemoy came at an awful time for Eisenhower. Precisely because he had been the subject of so much criticism for his alleged indecisiveness and complacency in confronting the Soviets on the world stage, Eisenhower felt that he must demonstrate resolve and firmness, those baleful key words of Cold War strategy. Privately, he admitted that the islands had no value in the defense of Taiwan itself, which was 100 miles away across the rough and stormy Taiwan Strait and defended by the U.S. 7th Fleet. Nonetheless, the ill-conceived Formosa Resolution of 1955 had pledged the United States to defend Taiwan and related nationalist possessions, and seemed to imply that Quemoy fell under this umbrella of protection. Chiang meant to hold the United States to its word. By 1958, he had placed 130,000 nationalist soldiers on Quemoy. When Mao commenced his artillery barrage, Chiang could say that if Quemoy was taken by the communists, Taiwan would have lost 1/3 of its army and would be vulnerable to a direct Chinese attack on Taiwan itself. Chiang argued that if the United States was serious about containing the menace of communist China, it must commit itself to protect Quemoy, even if that meant attacking mainland China itself. Once again, Chiang put on a master class of how the tail wags the dog. Eisenhower and Dulles faced a nasty dilemma. Either they could declare solidarity with Chiang and commit American forces to the defense of Quemoy, risking all-out war with China, or they could declare Quemoy to be outside the sphere of American interest and leave it to its fate. The first choice, defend Chiang and his islands at all cost, likely meant war, and even the use of nuclear weapons. That outcome did not seem hypothetical. In the spring of 1957, the United States had sent 40 Matador nuclear-tipped cruise missiles to Taiwan. As recently as June 1958, American military leaders had accepted a policy paper stating that the only way the United States, so far from its own bases of support, could fight against China, even in a limited war to protect Taiwan, would be by using nuclear weapons. In the first week of the Communist artillery,